You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of July 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Tig Enright, and coming up on the programme, what did Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin talk about in their two-hour-long face-to-face chat in Helsinki?
There was no collusion. I didn't know the president. There was nobody to collude with. There was no collusion with the campaign. And every time you hear all of these, you know, 12 and 14, it's stuff that has nothing to do. And frankly, they admit these are not people involved in the campaign.
But while the US spin cycle is wrapped up with what its president said in public, Russia claims that in private they talked about military cooperation. Well, staying on the theme of Russia, we'll also assess the geopolitical ramifications of its new gas pipeline to Germany. And with trade walls going up around the United States and potentially Britain, we'll discuss the new deal between the EU and Japan that tears down the barriers between them. Also on the Monocle Daily, Brussels slaps a record-breaking $5 billion fine on Google for abusing its dominant position. It can certainly afford to pay it, but what are the farther-reaching consequences? We'll also take a ride on London's new elevated cycleway. And before we go, how safety authorities in Chicago are using ketchup to stop bloodshed on its roads. That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. Welcome to the programme. I'm Tig Enright. Now, while the White House tries to extinguish the fire that Donald Trump lit upon himself in Helsinki earlier this week, in Russia, state propaganda is parroting that Vladimir Putin secured a range of agreements during their face-to-face meeting about military cooperation between the two powers. Washington has said very little about the content of their two-hour-long private meeting while it tries to deal with the fallout of what the US president said publicly about alleged Russian election hacking. So what exactly is to be believed? Well, Russia analyst Stephen DL joins me now on the line. Welcome to the programme, Stephen. First of all, talk to me about the military cooperation that Moscow is talking about. What exactly are they claiming?
Well, the Russian Ministry of Defence has come out today and said that Presidents Putin and Trump discussed the an extension of the START treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, interaction in Syria, and other matters, they say, of military security. Now, the point is, because by his own admission, Trump had no agenda for the meeting with Putin, there was no proper preparation, and, of course, he met him one-to-one with only their interpreters present, we have no way of knowing if this is true or not. So the Russians, you know, I mean, this man keeps doing things that baffle us, shall we say. I mean, this has got to be one of the most stupid things he's ever done, because, you know, he's just given the Russians, handed them on a plate so they can turn around and say, oh, but, you know, you promised this, that and the other. There's no record of the meeting. What's more, of course, he then had this ridiculous gaffe where he said, you know, when I said would, I meant wouldn't, the story from yesterday. And he even, when he left the press conference, he left his script on the dais, and Russian TV was the first to it and get a picture of it. I mean, the mistakes just go on and on.
They certainly do. And there is, of course, a very long list of things that they should have been talking about during that private meeting. But when we analyse the elements there that Sputnik, the one of the various Russian propaganda outlets, is saying they discussed, such as the START treaty and cooperation in Syria, let's just analyse those things one by one. Is there anything that, should they necessarily, there's no reason they shouldn't have been talking about those things, is there?
There's no reason they shouldn't have been, had it been a properly organised meeting. You know, had there been an agenda, then you would expect these things to have been laid out on it. And, you know, then Trump could turn around and say, look, you know, this is what I went in to talk about. And that's, you know, that's right. The Russians are saying that. But he hasn't got a leg to stand on at all. The Russian Ministry of Defence, I have to say, they've been quite clever in saying that these things were discussed, because, you know, we have no way of knowing whether they were or not. My own feeling is that, you know, Trump is so far away from the reality of what he should be doing as president, that perhaps I'm being overly sarcastic, but I just wonder if he even knows what START is.
Indeed. And I suppose when the same questions are asked of the Pentagon about what it was they talked about, they are playing their cards very close to their chest, perhaps because given that there were only two men in the room and some interpreters, they might not even know themselves.
Absolutely. And this is not the first time he's done this either. When the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, visited Washington a few months ago. First of all, Trump gave him the honor of a meeting in the Oval Office, which is normally reserved for heads of state, and Lavrov is not the head of state, he's the foreign minister. And the only other person present, Lavrov, of course, speaks fluent English. In fact, Putin's English is pretty good, too. So, even with interpreters, Putin had a good idea of what was being said at this meeting. But when Lavrov visited, they could speak freely in English. But the only other person present was a Russian journalist. This is building into a catalogue of errors, of incompetence. I'm not quite sure how we sum it up.
What are your old contacts in Moscow telling you about how the Kremlin was, I suppose, one would expect, celebrating the fallout from Monday's meeting?
Oh, the feeling there is that it's almost humorous. They're slightly wary, and they're not crowing. I think it's very interesting that, the way it's come out via Sputnik, a comment from the Russian Defense Ministry, they're putting forward things which, as you quite rightly said, might have been discussed, should have been discussed, perhaps. But I think that they are, the Russian system, and certainly I'm getting this from Russians I know who may have an idea of how the Kremlin works. They are wary of crowing too much and of being too too boastful, perhaps, about what was said, because they have had a few shocks themselves from President Trump already, that he doesn't always stick to any sort of script. So they are wary of saying too much about, isn't this great? They don't want to give the impression that he's entirely in their pocket. They went through that just after the election, even an MP sort of saying, "Our man is in the White House," a Russian MP saying, "Our man is in the White House." They are so baffled at times, as the rest of us are, by the way in which he behaves. They're holding off the boastful, the crowing nature. Just by putting out this statement, as I said before, it's quite clever on their part. They're saying, "Well, this is what he said." And it's very difficult, impossible now for Trump to turn around and say, "No, I didn't discuss that."
One of the counter-arguments to the allegations of collusion has been that, if there were collusion and Russia did deliberately meddle or indeed if the Trump campaign complied or colluded with that meddling, what has Moscow actually gotten out of it after a year and a half of him being in power? Until, I suppose, Monday's meeting, because that was quite a diplomatic victory.
That was certainly a diplomatic victory, but I think that the Russians will be quietly satisfied with the general thrust of the last 18 months of Trump's, well, the 18 months so far of Trump's presidency, because divisions in NATO have been emphasized. I mean, Trump went into that meeting shortly, a few days after a meeting at NATO in which he criticized all his NATO allies. When he had the G7 meeting before his meeting with Kim Jong-un back in June, he criticized the G7. Russia has always made it clear, at least I should say the Putin regime has always made it clear, that they are delighted when the West shows its weakness. The West shows divisions between organizations such as NATO, such as the European Union, the G7. And so what we've had, and of course there's the Brexit process now as well, and Trump stuck his oar into that before he met Theresa May last week, the British Prime Minister. So that these cracks that have appeared in the Western organizations, that suits Moscow very well. Moscow sees the West, at least I say Moscow, this is President Putin and his clique, they see the West as a threat to their power and wealth. And so anything that weakens the West or shows the West as being in a weak position plays to their tune. So they would look back, I think, on the 18 months that have passed so far with Trump as president and say, going as pretty well as we would like it to.
Okay, worrying time. Stephen Dale, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to Monocle 24. We'll stay on the theme of Russia after this.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Time in Berlin is 23:12. It's 12 minutes past midnight in Moscow, where there remains a mixture of shell shock in the German capital and glee in Moscow at the recent visit to Europe by US President Trump. Well, let's forget for a moment the bromance between him and his Russian counterpart and the barefaced insults towards Britain's Theresa May, and focus instead on what the president had to say about Germany, that a new gas pipeline makes Germany a captive of Russia. Well, Malcolm Grinson is a nuclear policy and power market analyst and joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Malcolm. Is this one of those slightly galling situations where Donald Trump has got a point?
It's an interesting one because the economics looks okay with this. What's going on is that Europe is becoming more dependent on imported gas. Norwegian supplies are limited. The UK supplies are depleting quite quickly. Russia is the biggest supplier of gas for the European Union. So the new pipeline more or less mirrors an existing one and doubles its capacity down from Russia through the Baltic Sea into the former East Germany. Now, the Russians say it's the right place for a pipeline because most of their gas reserves are in the northwest of the country. The Germans say, because this is part of the former East Germany, they say we've got a long relationship with the Russians going back for decades and decades. It's never caused us any problems. We get on fine. Germany generally, particularly as it moves away from nuclear, is having to burn a lot more fossil fuel, so it needs to import more gas. The problems are several. One of them is this point, that the more dependent we become on Russia or Europe becomes dependent on Russia for imported gas, the stronger Mr. Putin's position will be. I don't believe he'll switch the gas taps off to Western Europe willy-nilly because he wants to sell the gas. So that's why he's doing it.
Are there other options? And are they practical options?
Yes. One of the reasons why Mr. Trump, I think, is so much against this is that the Americans, after the fracking revolution in the States, are now producing vastly more gas than anyone dreamt they would, and indeed are on the border of being a net gas exporter. They've started exporting to the United Kingdom, for example. There are liquefied natural gas terminals in Poland, just over the German border, which could take a lot of American gas. So from Mr. Putin's point of view, if the Germans decided to buy more of his gas and not build this pipeline, it would obviously be very good economically for the US. But it is more expensive. Natural gas through a pipeline is perhaps a quarter less expensive than it is through by liquefying it and bringing it in by tanker.
Given, though, the kind of the toxic geopolitics of our time, one might have thought that Germany would kind of go to hell or high water to avoid having to do this.
Well, it is a crazy world, isn't it? Where you know, this is one where
the craziness is temporary and the need for gas is hopefully...
Well, Germany's been importing Russian gas since 1973. Let's be clear, this isn't an entirely new concept. And throughout that time, Germany hasn't faced any problems. Actually, the geopolitics, I think, in a way, may be more about Ukraine in particular. At the moment, considerable amounts of gas go through pipelines through the Ukraine, and the Ukraine gets a fee for hosting that pipeline. Now, that deal comes to an end in 2019, which is roughly when the new pipeline might be available. The Ukrainians get something like $3 billion a year for that, which is a huge contribution to a rather shaky economy. And if they lost that money, then the possibility of further instability in the Ukraine, which of course has already caused huge problems because of the Crimea, I think there is a potential geopolitical, maybe not flashpoint, but certainly difficulty there. And Russia has a long history over the last decade or decade and a half of periodically cutting off the gas into Ukraine as part of the post-Soviet breakup conflict.
So they'll do that to Ukraine, which is kind of more of a sworn enemy to a certain extent than Western Europe. But you know, how much does Russia need this pipeline as much as actually as Germany does, and to what extent does that lessen the likelihood of a diplomatic spat, seeing the taps turned off?
I think it would be more, I think a more realistic possibility, for example, is Russia responding to the threats of further sanctions from the European Union by saying, OK, if that's the game you want to play, then we have a game that we can play as well? I think that's where the concern is, rather than an overt attack, because the Russian economy is enormously dependent on its exports of oil and gas. That's its major export, I think, by some way. And so, you know, as is the case with any internationally traded good, both sides get benefit out of it, and interrupting that trade damages both sides.
And one of the things that's easy to forget is that while the politicians squabble, business people are very happily doing business across borders.
Indeed. Well, the first of the pipelines was co-funded by both sides of the deal. Although the new pipeline will be totally owned by the Russians, there is commercial money going in from Germany, from Austria, from France, from Royal Dutch Shell, for example, from Onagy, which used to be the Gaz de France in France. So there's a lot of private sector money going into this pipeline, because clearly businesses, you see, and gas in many ways is still the wonder fuel. It is cleaner than coal, although it does still have very significant greenhouse gas emission implications. But you can store it, you can use it extremely efficiently, either for electricity or for direct space heating. It's great stuff if it wasn't for this problem with climate change. But in terms of an industrial feedstock, it's pretty close to being the wonder fuel.
If only we had more. Malcolm Grimson, thank you very much. You are listening to the Monocle Daily. Coming up next, a big step forward for world trade. Live from London, this is the Monocle Daily. Just as the United States erects new trade barriers with some of its most significant trading partners, an economic wall of sorts has come tumbling down between the world's single biggest trading bloc, the European Union, and the planet's third most significant economy, Japan. Well, the timing is almost ironic when you consider the chaos that Donald Trump has sown in the trading world order and the knots in which Britain's Brexiteers are tying themselves up to tear up their most important trading relationship in the hope of forging some new ones. Well, joining me to analyse the significance of the day's events, Peter Goodman, European economics correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome to the programme, Peter.
Thanks very much.
This deal has been, of course, in the works for some time, maybe even before Brexit was a kind of a word or a concept in our minds. But should it in itself be a kind of a cautionary tale to the hard Brexiteers that has taken this long for the EU and Japan to get something over the line?
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Yes, it's true that negotiating a trade deal is complicated. It involves expertise. And Britain hasn't had to negotiate a trade deal for a really long time. For decades, it's relied on the EU. That's a core competence of the EU. Now, it's interesting that you're casting it as, you know, a sign of how long it takes. And that's true. But it's also true that this deal probably moved a lot faster because of Brexit and because of the trade war from the United States.
So you think there's no coincidence there? It's not coincidental timing that it's happening. The ink is drying just as the world order seems to be in trouble.
Well, you know, it's been really striking listening to the pronouncements about it coming out of Japan and out of Europe, specifically Brussels, where the officials who've put their signatures on it have said very pointedly, this is much more than a trade deal. This is not just about business. This is very much about reminding the world that we need to cooperate. We need to have multilateral institutions. We need to think beyond individual national interests. This is our post-World War II history. This is the liberal democratic order, and it's under direct attack, not only from Brexit, but more importantly, from President Trump.
One of the things you're pointing out there is that it takes expertise to forge a trade deal. Doesn't it also require, though, patience and prodding and convincing of vested interests in each jurisdiction to say that actually, you know, farmers will, you're going to have suffer sure. more imports of commodity X from the other jurisdiction?
I mean, trade involves trade-offs, and some people win and some people lose. And the idea is that if at the national level you force some industries to take the hit, I mean, you accept that if you are a German automaker, you're about to face significant new competition from Japanese auto imports in exchange for farmers across Europe getting greater access to the Japanese market. And the understanding is, well, in the aggregate, there should be a benefit. And then it's up to the national leaders to make sure those benefits are distributed, which, by the way, it must be pointed out, is not something that's been handled very well just about anywhere.
How long will it take to see the benefits of this in both jurisdictions? sanctions?
Some of the benefits will happen immediately. So, you know, if you're in Japan and you like Gouda cheese and you're tired of paying huge amounts of money for it, once this deal takes effect, assuming both parliaments approve it in 2019, there's going to be a significant reduction in the price of cheese. For consumers who buy cars in Europe, there will be some lowering of prices pretty quickly on Japanese cars, because it'll be easier for Japanese companies that have factories in Europe to import parts quickly. But a lot of this stuff will play out over decades.
There's a visit, I think, happening soon, a European delegation heading to Washington. And Donald Trump has suggested that they're there to talk about a trade deal. We know that there is there has been work going on between the EU and the United States to forge some kind of a trade deal. It hasn't gotten very far at all. Do you think, is that completely dead in the water, or could there actually be some progress on it?
I mean, it certainly looks dead for the time being. I mean, as long as Trump is the president of the United States, there's going to be tremendous distrust on this side of the Atlantic, which, I mean, in Brussels specifically, where, you know, they have noticed that Trump is now casting Europe as the arch foe of the United States. He just stood next to Vladimir Putin in Helsinki and said, "We're friends, and I'm going to take your word for it over that of my own intelligence agencies that you did not meddle in the American election."
Until he said otherwise, but anyway.
Until he said otherwise, and then he tweeted that actually he meant what he said initially. But it's very difficult to imagine a scenario where the U.S. and the EU negotiated trade.
What is the kind of your reality check, I think, for world trade? You know, even if this EU-Japan deal is somehow replicated by the EU and China at a time when the U.S. is throwing up more barriers, you know, will that mitigate the impact on the rest of the world and perhaps leave the U.S. behind? Or is it more the case that the U.S. will remain such an important cog in the wheel, such a powerful force, that everyone still suffers?
Well, it's both. I mean, there's no question that in a relative way, the U.S. and Britain are disadvantaged by this deal. If you are an American automaker and you're trying to crack either the European or the Japanese market with your product, you're facing tariffs that just went away for European and Japanese automakers in their respective markets. Likewise, I mean, if you are a British manufacturer and you're dependent upon a supply chain, and you're dependent upon investment. And the notion that Britain is this great jumping off point to serve the whole continent, well, that's just gone by the boards. And the attraction of being in the EU with not only a deal with Japan, but a trade deal with Canada recently inked, a deal with Korea, you're now on the sidelines of all of that in Britain. At the same time, the U.S. is the world's largest economy. It is an enormous economy with a lot of wealthy consumers, and countries are always going to want to crack at that.
Okay. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Peter Goodman of the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us today. You are listening to The Monocle Daily. I'm Tadhg Enright, and here are some of the other stories that we're following today. The 12 boys who were rescued from a flooded cave in Thailand last week have spoken publicly for the first time after they were released from hospital. They described the moment that rescue divers reached them as a miracle and paid tribute to a Thai Navy SEAL who died while trying to save them. An alleged Russian spy has been held without bail after appearing in a court in the US, accused of acting as an unregistered agent. Maria Butina is accused of dealing with Russian intelligence and seeking funding from wealthy oligarchs to sponsor her trip to America, where the FBI believes she tried to infiltrate the National Rifle Association. And the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has given his cabinet a shake-up ahead of his re-election bid next year. Six ministers have swapped jobs and five new members have joined the top table of government. A spokesperson said the changes would help the government focus on innovation and trade at a time when Canada needs to find new trading partners. This is The Monocle Daily. The time is 23:26 in Brussels, which put itself in the international spotlight today, slapping a $5 billion fine on the world's leading tech company, Google. The European Commission said that Google has been abusing the dominant position it has in mobile operating systems. In Google's case, it's Android software, which is the most common platform for smartphones and other mobile devices, to cement its dominant position in the internet search market. Well, Josh Cowles is a researcher on the ethics of data at the Alan Turing Institute, and he joins me in studio. Welcome, Josh, to the programme. Tell me first, what are the technicalities of this? Explain for us what Google has done wrong in Brussels' eyes.
Sure. So in the eyes of the commission, Google committed a couple of illegal practices in relation to their Android operating system. First of all, they, through a combination of carrots and sticks, really required or strongly encouraged device manufacturers who use its Android operating system on mobiles to pre-install a set of Google apps, such as its Search app and its Chrome browser, onto the devices before they were launched. It's also got into some hot water in relation to really preventing people from using its sort of less updated OS version as well.
I mean, Google undoubtedly does have a dominant position, both in mobile operating systems and in search. And I suppose some people, you wouldn't have thought it actually needs to do anything to cement that.
I think that's right. And I think the elephant in the room here is that Google has a really good search engine. There's a reason a lot of people use it. Part of the reason is that it becomes preloaded on Android phones, but part of the reason is just that it works pretty well. And I think the bigger picture for Europe here, as they try to create a more competitive environment for small startup businesses, is that Google just has a load of data on its users, and that data set is increased every time someone uses the search engine. I think that's behind the European Commission's decision.
You mean you think they've got an ulterior motive here?
Well, I think that they're plucky at the kind of straws that they can pluck at in terms of what's legal and illegal. I think if they were being more ambitious, they might suggest breaking up Google altogether and just saying outright it's antitrust with its size and scale right now. I think that would be politically quite
a very courageous move if they did go down that road. I mean, a $5 billion fine, it is a record fine, but I mean, Google undoubtedly has the money to pay it if they wanted to. I believe they said they intend to appeal, but you know, even if they don't succeed, the consequences seem fairly not terribly severe. So, you know, Android buyers of a new Android phone will simply have to download the Google or Chrome apps if they want them.
I think that's probably true. And it's almost becoming a bit of an annual subscription that Google is paying to the European Commission at the moment. They paid a $2 billion dollar fine last year for a roughly similar violation. So this is more normal stuff in a way. On the other hand, there is one caveat here from what feels like quite distant history, which is that Microsoft was caught up in a similar scrap really is the word, I think, with the commission about 10 years ago about its preloading of its own Internet Explorer browser, which I suppose few people now use, on its Windows operating system. The core beneficiary of that decision was Google's young Chrome browser.
But wasn't probably the reason that Chrome benefited so much from that was that Internet Explorer was terrible. I mean, as you rightly say, the EC does love to dole out big fines to tech companies. But I wonder, you know, has there been, or even in the case of the fine that was doled out last year, I believe one of them in recent years has been about giving Google shopping preferences, listings preference on search results. Have any of them actually had an impact on competition within the sectors?
Well, Google did change its practices around its Google Shopping service after that ruling. And it does seem to have given competitors, non-Google competitors, some leg up in the European space. Of course, when it has these decisions, it seldom applies them to the rest of the world. But that does create some interesting control conditions. So, for example, this browser-based decision has already been implemented in Russia, which has seen more pickup in its native browser as a result of that decision.
Isn't one of the issues in the whole of the tech world is that, you know, Apple, Android, whoever it is, or Google, whoever it is, they like what they have. They create what they call ecosystems, where one of their devices will only really talk to another of their devices. So if you buy an Apple device, chances are you're going to have an Apple phone and maybe an iPad as well. You've made a very dramatic suggestion that maybe the EC should tell Google to break itself up altogether. Maybe another way of doing it is actually instructing the tech companies to make their ecosystems actually talk to each other.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion, and I wish they would take it up. Apple has been conspicuously absent from this whole conversation in today's news. I think it's because actually, ironically, they just lock their system down much more. They don't try and license their operating system. They just sell their devices at a premium, and it seems to work for them. They're probably about to become the first ever trillion-dollar company in the next few months, so that approach seems to be working as well.
I'll be sure to send my suggestion in on a postcard to Brussels. Josh Cowles, thank you very much for joining us today on the Monocle Daily. It is time now for a tall story, a feature by the team behind The Urbanist, which takes you on an urban journey each week. This week, our editor Andrew Tuck goes cycling in London to bring us an elevated experience on the British capital's new pedway.
I first read about it in Monocle, actually. Then I had the story covered again for our upcoming book on urbanism. So I thought it was about time that I took myself off to see the project. So on a sunny morning, I cycled into the City of London to see a scheme that reimagines the elevated walkway and a lot more besides. London Wall Place is an office development inserted into a plot. It also includes the remains of the medieval St. Alphege Church and a section of the original Roman London Wall. In the endless cycle of redevelopment in the City of London, there's nothing intrinsically exciting about any of these facts. But go visit, because there are lots of impressive quality benchmarking details, not least that the scheme literally works on so many levels. In numerous post-war architecture projects, the elevated walkway, or pedway, was the go-to solution for cities that imagined the street would become the domain of the car. In places such as London, however, they were often poorly maintained, rain-swept, badly lit, and soon associated with all sorts of nefarious activities. People certainly didn't like using them at night. But at London Wall Place, they have a surprisingly beautiful new reincarnation. Linking the site with neighbours, such as the brutalist Barbican Centre, they're made from rust-red steel and with you-want-to-touch-me smooth wooden handrails. There are walkways that cling to the sides of buildings, others that weave with a snaky, sinuous confidence. And when you climb up onto them, well, it's pleasing. You walk above the traffic, the ruins, the planting. Oh yes, the planting, that's glorious too. There is greenery spilling over handrails, banks of quivering grasses, sunken spots to sit and think, or at least have a Pret sandwich. It's stunning. The planners say that there are 45,000 square feet of new green space. In metric, it's quite big. But it's the pedways that charm and allure. It's the fresh angle that you view your city from, that new perspective. It's so reviving.
Thanks indeed to Andrew Tuck for taking us on London's Pedway. You can hear more on The Urbanist. Tune in to the full programme tomorrow at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24. After this, we'll have the morning newspapers from Asia. Isabel Hilton is here to review them.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world. Every Sunday, The Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1600 London time. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
The time is 5:36 in Beijing. It's 22:36 here in London. Time now for a check on the Asian front pages. I'm joined today by Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Welcome to the programme, Isabel. You've picked out a selection of analyses, as it were, from Asia of the new Trump-Putin relationship, the world reshaping itself. Talk to me first about the Global Times view.
Well, the Global Times, which, as you may know, is a highly nationalistic newspaper, newspaper in China. So I was interested to see what they made of this spectacle. And they have a sort of meta-narrative. So they report the press conference, but they're really interested in what's being said in the United States about the press conference. And they report the criticism of Trump. But instead of explaining it by Trump's behavior, they're essentially arguing that Trump has a genuine desire for good relations with Russia. No mention of any reasons why you shouldn't have good relations with Russia, no mention of Ukraine or nerve gas or anything. And it explains the hostility to this policy in the United States by the fact that the United States in general has not let go of its, you know, its desire for hegemony. So essentially, you know, it's not tolerable in the United States amongst the elites or in the media to be friendly with Russia. And that's the Global Times' explanation. And they finish off by saying that really no Asian country can be friendly with the United States, and China ought to remember that. So it's a little warning.
Quite a dramatic statement. But then, of course, not out of character, one might think, clearly going down a kind of a Trump or US bashing line. A little bit more of a more typical Western attitude in Hong Kong, in the South China Morning Post.
Well, they straddle this, this difficult position between, you know, being business and international and being part of China these days. But they have published a piece which essentially says, look, this is a dire situation, but there are much better ways that both the EU and China, and there was an EU-China summit meeting last week, that they can respond to this, so that instead of imposing tariffs in retaliation, which will only hurt themselves, they should simply allow the United States to inflict its own damage on itself. And meanwhile, forge a kind of relationship which would allow them to be the setters of standards and to set an example of real commitment to free trade, upholding the WTO and so on. So that's a kind of, you know, constructive response which is being argued there, very much in contrast with what's coming out of Beijing. So
How do you think the EU will kind of respond to this pushing of friendship between it and or the encouragement that there is for it to forge a deeper friendship with China, given the new Trump world order?
Well, the EU's stepped back a little bit from the entire embrace of China, because China at one point before the summit was trying to get the EU to essentially sign up to a kind of critical position vis-a-vis the United States, which the EU was not ready to do. But it is all of this is realigning things in the region, and the EU is, you know, negotiating with China. Clearly, there are lots of areas of cooperation that would work, but at the same time, you've got Japan, which is also arguing. So if you look at the Japan Times on this issue, and Japan has just signed a major trade pact with the European Union. Mm-hmm. It's a very important deal. And the Japan Times is arguing that instead of cuddling up to the big panda, which with all the kind of influence buying and you know, undue influence that would give China over the EU, Japan is arguing that it's a much better route to go down to maintain and develop the relationship with Japan and use that as the standard setting issue. All of these pieces are saying tariffs are really not the point. You know, the point is essentially who sets the rules of global trade. And that does include standard setting and all kinds of non-tariff barriers. Japan is arguing, look, we are essentially, you know, subscribe to Western standards and we subscribe to transparency and all the things that the EU should wish to defend, so that don't go with China, we're a better option. Mm-hmm. So it's all part of the fallout, really, from the Trump the Trump behaviour.
And does Beijing kind of view this kerfuffle as an opportunity to kind of further its own goals closer to home? A piece you picked out of the Global Times was talking about a PLA drill in the East China Sea.
Well, yes, this is another bit of kind of curious Chinese diplomacy. So, as you may know, that in Taiwan, we currently have a government, which is the DPP, which is the Taiwanese party, as opposed to the Kuomintang, which is the Nationalist Party, which is a kind of pro-China, originally a Chinese mainland party. when the Kuomintang are in power in Taiwan, essentially they get on fine with Beijing. And so when you have the Taiwanese party, the DPP, which is in power, there's always a bit of an anxiety that they will push the independence from China. So when you get a situation like this, Beijing is both pressuring Taiwan, and right now it's conducting this extraordinary live fire exercise, which is over an area of the East China Sea, which is the size of Taiwan, as Global Times tells us. At the same time, receiving in Beijing, in a very friendly way, a leading Kuomintang politician. So he's being feted by Xi Jinping, told really there's no problem that we can't sort out, but meanwhile, there is this live fire exercising. And in Washington, the head of mainland affairs from Taiwan is saying, hey, guys, we need more support here. So you've got and criticizing this carrot and stick policy.
Let's push on and talk about other pressing Chinese matters, namely the economy and different perspectives that you've picked out for us on its corporate debt crisis.
Well, this is a very unusual moment. I mean, a lot of people have been very worried about the level of Chinese debt for quite some time, and not only the level of the debt, but the speed with which it's been going up. And there appears to be a kind of public spat. This is reported in Caixin magazine, which is a prominent business magazine, and in the Global Times, between the People's Bank of China and the finance ministry. And this is pretty unusual for China because officials don't normally criticize each other. So it starts off with the People's Bank of China essentially complaining that the finance ministry is not doing enough to stabilize the economy. Meanwhile, in the kind of wider landscape, you have all sorts of private businesses finding that there is essentially a credit crunch and they can't roll over debt and they're going bankrupt. And the IMF, in its six-monthly review of global economic stability, saying China is still very worrying. So, you know, you have a bit of a build-up of anxiety. It comes and goes in terms of China's debt. But at the moment, we do seem to be seeing, if these reports are accurate, and they appear to be Caixin's very responsible magazine, that there are real kind of disputes within the Chinese, economic managers about whether we should be stabilizing the Chinese economy through fiscal measures or whether the bank, should be taking a bigger role. That's very unusual.
Finally, Isabel, let's talk a little bit about why you might not want to fly with China Airlines.
China, I know we had a bit of a Ryanair episode the other day, but you may not have noticed that there's unfortunate passengers on Air China found themselves plunging, 25,000 feet.
Not something all of a sudden. Wants.
The reason was that up in the cockpit, where there were three co-pilots, there was a certain amount of vaping going on. And so to conceal the fact that the pilots were smoking, they turned off the air conditioning. The result of that was that the oxygen levels in the aircraft dropped precipitously. The oxygen mask came down and the plane just, crashed down, one of those precipitate descents. And they then sort of, went back up to their cruising altitude and carried on and landed, hoping nobody would notice. But I'm afraid they have all been disciplined, and the airline, which is the national carrier, has had its hours cut, has been severely rebuked. And I think you might want to think twice about flying Air China.
I've always said that vaping is a bad idea. Isabel Hilton, thank you very much for coming in and taking us through your pick of the Asian newspapers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now let's go to Chicago now. Internationally renowned as the Windy City, the birthplace of the skyscraper, home to an incredible jazz scene and, of course, the pizza pie. Perhaps less known, though, is a disdain among ordinary Chicagoans for perhaps the most American of food ingredients, ketchup. And that bizarre aversion to tomato sauce has been channeled by road safety authorities in the city to draw attention to their safety messages, which now read, no texting, no speeding, no ketchup. Well, let's cross to Chicago now and speak to Kate Burneau, Associate Editor at The Takeout in Chicago. Welcome to the programme, Kate. Explain for us, first of all, if you will, what is with this aversion to ketchup?
I Well, first of all, I'm excited to be here. And I wish I could explain fully this psychological aversion to ketchup, but it's really just a citywide phenomenon. People have theories about where this came from, but it's really because Chicago has a specific style hot dog that is associated with it. And there is no ketchup on that hot dog, no ketchup allowed. And that's where this sort of ketchup phobia comes from. Now, it's mostly related to hot dogs, but sometimes you'll see restaurants also say no ketchup even on French fries. So it's very serious.
So born on a hot dog, or rather not on a hot dog, how much of an embargo is there on ketchup in the city? I mean, like, if I go to a supermarket, can I pick up a bottle of Heinz?
You will be able to buy that ketchup, but don't let anyone
just don't use it.
Right. Don't let anyone see you put that on, especially a hot dog. So there are even restaurants that, you know, refuse to stock ketchup on the counters of their hot dog stands. You'll see signs with a big X over the ketchup, the red bottle. It is pretty serious. It would be a huge faux pas for a public figure to eat a hot dog with ketchup in that city.
Okay, well, let's talk about the serious stuff then, and this tactic that's been deployed by the road safety authorities there. And big kind of electronic billboards hanging over highways that read, no texting, no speeding, no ketchup. What's the big idea?
The road safety authorities say that, you know, this is to draw attention to the issue of, you know, being safe on the road. But what I sort of find curious is I think it's having the exact opposite effect, because my Twitter and Facebook feeds were full of people in their cars taking photos of the sign. So I'm not sure that it really had its intended effect, because I think everyone immediately pulled out their cell phone while driving to take a photo. So good to draw attention to the sign, but maybe not in the way they intended.
People are talking about it, though, and hopefully, I suppose, that's drawing attention to at least the first two elements of that safety message.
I think more people are talking about the ketchup than speeding. But here we are talking about, you know, the importance of speeding and not texting while driving. So mission accomplished for them.
How long have these signs been hanging up at this stage?
It seems that they went up over this past weekend is when I saw the most is when I saw everyone noticing them for the first time when I saw them for the first time. So it seems that it was this past weekend.
And you know, what's the political consensus, if there is one, as to whether they are working or not, or whether they're a good idea or not?
Well, people are certainly noticing them and sharing photos of them. So I guess if that was the intention, then they're working. But I don't know. You know, we'll have to look back a month from now and see if the roads got so much safer after these signs went up. I don't have that data yet.
I'd love to know if Heinz has ever led a kind of a charm offensive in the city to win people over.
I think they would have quite the uphill battle. It would not be accepted without quite a struggle. I don't think you could give away free ketchup in Chicago, frankly.
Wow. And as a Simpsons aficionado myself, I've often wondered, what is the difference between ketchup and catsup and a non-American?
I think it's just a spelling, unless we're talking tomaco, which is an entirely different crop altogether.
Tomaco, yes, that's the one which had the tobacco built into it.
It's so delicious, you just can't stop eating it.
Yeah, and funny, we were just talking about vaping on planes, and I just wonder if another source of tobacco for the body is tobacco-infused tomatoes. I think the Simpsons might have, like so many things in life, they were ahead of their visionaries, ahead of their time. They can see the future.
They have predicted every good, bad, or strange event of the last 10 years, it seems.
Okay, well done them. Kate Bernot, Associate Editor of The Takeout in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Daily tonight. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the Monocle Daily. It was very well produced by Ben Rylan and Daniel Bache, researched by Daphne Karnezis and Julia Webster, and studio managed by Kenya Scarlett. The Globalist will be back in 8 hours' time, just over 8 hours' time. Georgina Godwin will be in the chair for the agenda-setting show for Europe. Paul Osborne will be back with the Monocle Daily at the very same time tomorrow. We leave you tonight with a tribute to the Caped Crusader. It was on this day in 2008 that The Dark Knight hit theatres, starring Heath Ledger as the Joker. It's often considered as one of the greatest films of the 21st century. Playing us out tonight, Prince with a track from 1989's Batman, It's Bat Dance. For me, Tig Enright, it's goodbye. And thank you very much for joining us tonight on the Monocle Daily.